Chairman, ladies and gentlemen, first of all, I must begin by thanking the Japan Society for inviting me, the Japan Foundation for inviting us here. They treated my wife and myself with such exquisite kindness and courtesy that it would be very churlish of me not to begin by saying how very grateful we are. In the second place, let me thank the three previous speakers. I'm afraid I didn't understand a word they said, but I've learned out, I've rather gathered from various references to proper names, such as Oxford, titular professor, All Souls College, Tolstoy, Herder, and names of that kind that I was being referred to. I imagine that in particular, both the speeches of President Cohen and Professor Fukuda, that you probably have had a much fuller biography of me than I myself possess. I'm sure you know more about me now than I know about myself. I assume that some of the things said were probably not wholly unfavorable to me. And if so, I should like to thank Professor Fukuda for his very kind words to me, and President Cohen too, I'm sure they were. I feel sure they must have praised me more than I deserved, but of course it's much nicer to be praised more than one deserves than one deserves. For all this, I'm most grateful. Now, if I may, I'll come to the topic of my lecture. My topic is utopianism. But before beginning this lecture, may I say, put my cards on the table. I intend to talk, really, about two types of ideology which appear to contend against each other in the modern world. And utopianism is simply a peg on which I wish to hang them. In one of them, and that is the one which is, I think has persisted in the Western world for, say, 3,000 years, the principal values are truth, the pursuit of the truth, the discovery of the truth, and respect for those who get things right, either by knowing, as they say, or by accomplishing something. For example, statesmen who govern well, or conquerors who conquer well, and so forth. This, I think, is, roughly speaking, the kind of values that were respected from about, as I say, about 3,000 years ago until well into the 17th century. After that, another constellation of values enters, by which a certain respect is paid to virtues which are not respected at the previous period, such as, for example, sincerity and integrity. So far as I know, nobody before the 17th century ever praised anybody for sincerely holding a view which he believed to be false. Martyrdom was always respected, provided it was martyrdom for the truth. But if you were a martyr for something which the critic did not believe was true, it was merely pathetic. It was not something deserving of profound respect. Another thing that has arisen is, for example, our respect for, or our interest in variety. As far as I know, before a certain period, before the 17th century, variety is not praised. On the whole, truth is one, error is many. One is good, many is bad. I shall try to illustrate that from what I have to say about utopia. And there are certain other values which have also arisen comparatively lately. When people say there is nothing new under the sun, this appears to me to be a ringing falsehood. New things do happen. New values arise. And it's quite interesting for historians of thought to trace their origin and their development. Now let me come to my proper subject. The idea of a perfect society is a very old dream. Whether because of the misfortunes and ills of the present, which make men conceive of what it would be like to be without them, to conceive of some world in which there was no misery, and no greed, and no fear, and no danger, and no insecurity, or whether these utopias are visions and images constructed in order to criticize the present, simply as satires on what goes on in our world, or simple exercises in poetical imagination, utopias are very old. Broadly speaking, they always contain the same elements. They are a society of pure harmony, in which all men are friendly to each other, love one another, are free from danger, free from hunger, free from insecurity, are not frustrated, do not experience injustice or violence of any kind, live in a perpetual kind of light which never varies. And this is true of almost every utopia that that has ever been produced. Its main characteristics are the fact that these utopias are static. Nothing in them alters. Having achieved perfection, there is nowhere else to go. The assumption of it, of course, is that men have a certain fixed, unaltering nature. They have certain fixed, unaltering goals. Once these goals are realized, total fulfillment of human nature ensues. Fulfillment presupposes that men have purposes. All men, qua men, are thought to have identical central purposes. Unless this is true, the utopia cannot be a utopia, that is to say, the perfect society cannot be perfect for everyone. The view which the normal form of utopia is to say, once upon a time there was a golden age. It is so with Homer. Homer talks about the happy Phoenicians, or he talks about the blessed Ethiopians among whom Zeus loves to spend his time, or he talks about the Isles of the Blessed. Hesiod talks about a golden age which is then succeeded by an iron and a copper age, and a bad time in which he lives himself, and to which he compares it. Plato speaks of a symposium, in the symposium, of the fact that men were once spherical in shape, and then broken half, and each hemisphere is trying to find its appropriate hemisphere for the purpose of once again becoming rounded and perfect. Virgil speaks about Saturnia Regna, the kingdom of Saturn, in which all things were good. Plato speaks about Atlantis, the lost kingdom of Atlantis, in similar terms. The same thing occurs in the paradise of the Bible, in which Adam and Eve were once blameless and happy and serene, a situation which might have gone on forever, but didn't. In all these cases, let me give you a typical quotation. Tennyson, more or less adapting from Homer, speaks of a kingdom where falls not hail, nor rain, nor any snow, nor ever wind blows loudly. This is a Homeric sentiment. Homer speaks of an eternal light which blows upon a windless world. These are people who believe that the Golden Age was before. Then there are, of course, the thinkers who think the Golden Age is still to come, like, for example, the Hebrew prophets. The prophet Isaiah speaks, in the last days men shall beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Nations shall not lift swords against nation, nor shall they make war, learn war anymore. The wolf shall dwell with the lamb, the leopard shall lie down with the kid. The desert shall bloom like a rose. Sorrow and sighing shall flee away. Similarly, St. Paul speaks of a world in which there will be neither Jew nor Greek, neither man nor woman, in which all men shall be equal, neither slave nor free, all men shall be equal, and all men shall be perfect in the sight of God. It doesn't matter whether this world is conceived of as an earthly paradise or something beyond the grave. What is common to all these is, as I say, there is a kind of static state of perfection in which the central human nature is fully realized and all frustrations are seeking to God. There are, of course, political versions of this. In Plato's, there are hierarchical versions and there are democratic versions. In Plato's Republic, you have a rigid hierarchy of three classes, which is based on the proposition that there are three types of human nature. In Zeno, the Stoic, you have an anarchy, in which all rational beings live in perfect peace and happiness with each other without institutions. If men are rational, they do not need control. There is no need for the state, there is no need for money, there is no need for law courts, there is no need for any institutions at all. Men and women shall wear identical clothes. Men and women shall do whatever they wish, provided they are rational, all their wishes are rational, and all their wishes can be fulfilled. Not very much of Zeno's utopia remains, but the fragments indicate that it is some kind of great anarchical world in which total reason prevails. The same thing occurs, for example, there are all kinds of utopias. There is the utopia of Theopompus, there is the utopia of Euthymerus, in which happy men live in islands in the Arabian Sea. There are no wild animals, there is no winter, there is no spring, there is an eternal moderate summer. Fruits fall into their mouths from trees, there is no labor. Everything is perfect, there is an utter condition of totally unceasing bliss in which these human beings dwell, provided they are divided from the wicked, sinful, chaotic world which goes through all kinds of tribulations. That is why they are on islands. The sea divides them. Long may it keep them free. That is roughly the sentiment. In fact, some people try to realize this. For example, Zeno's disciple Glossius, who was a Roman Stoic, did inspire ideas, which I think came originally from the communist Iamblos, in the minds of various Romans, who did try and construct some kind of communist paradise in a part of Asia Minor, in Pergamon, which was of course destroyed by the Romans, who held a kind of trial of various persons who were responsible for it, not unlike the McCarthyite investigations in the United States. It's not dissimilar. They grilled Tiberius, they grilled Caius Gracchus, they grilled Blossius, they grilled Aristonicus, they grilled various philosophers about whether, in fact, they planted subversive ideas in the minds of Roman citizens. And of course, it ended in the death of Caius Gracchus and the arrest and imprisonment of the wicked third. However, this is, by the way. The same thing occurs during the Middle Ages. There is a certain slump in utopias, largely because, according to Christian faith, man cannot achieve this by his efforts alone, only by divine grace, which cannot come to him while he is on this earth. So long as we are in the veil of tears, we must suffer, and various miseries must fall upon us. But what is common to the ancient utopians is always the same story. Once upon a time, there was a perfect period. Then some enormous disaster occurred. In the Bible, disobedience to God, the eating of the apple, or the flood, or wicked giants came and disturbed the world, or some other fearful disaster came upon them. Deucalion and Terra, the flood, and also in Greek mythology. Something always comes to disturb this world, something comes to break this perfection, and the rest, after the disaster, whatever it may be, there is an attempt to piece together the fragments in order to, once again, to return to the ancient serenity, to piece together the fragments so that the perfection may be realized once again. This may not be possible owing to human stupidity or wickedness or other reasons, or God may not permit it, but the whole of history is interpreted as a kind of agonized effort to piece together the broken bits of the perfect urn with which the universe began. This is a very persistent idea which goes through European thought from the beginning and until comparatively recently. That is why utopian thought is very central to the general conception of the universe in both political and moral thought. Let me examine certain assumptions which lie behind this and which are of considerable importance in the history of Western thought. I think perhaps not so much in the history of Japanese thought, about which I know almost nothing, but I suspect there is a difference. The assumptions in the case of European thought are these. You see, this search after unity, this search after wholeness, this notion that perfection is, so to speak, a condition of the total realization of human unity, of harmony, of wholeness, of the togetherness of men all bound together by the realization of their common nature, something of that kind, I think, is a very profound and permanent Western assumption. It rests on the following. Let me put them in the form of three propositions, a kind of three-legged stool on which Western thought rests. The first proposition is quite simple. To all serious questions, there can only be one true answer. All the other answers being false. If there is not one true answer, then the question cannot be a genuine question. If the question is a genuine question, it must have an answer. And if it must have an answer, there can only be one true answer. No question can have two answers which are different and yet both true. That's assumption number one. Assumption number two is that there is a method for discovering these true answers, whatever it may be. Somebody can know it. Whether anyone knows it is another question. But somebody, by using the method, could know it. The third assumption, and perhaps the most important from our point of view, this lecture, is that all the true answers must be at least compatible with one another. That is a simple logical truth. One true proposition cannot be incompatible with another true proposition. Therefore, all these answers, whether they are answers to questions, what is there in the world, or whether they are answers to the question, what should men do, or how should men be, it doesn't matter, in other words, whether it's questions of fact or questions of value. For thinkers of this order, questions of value are questions of fact. All these answers, at best, entail one another in a single systematic logically interconnected whole. At worst, at least, are not incompatible with one another. They can be connected together into one harmonious whole. And when you have discovered all the true answers and put them together, this will be the blueprint of the perfect life. Perhaps you can't know it. There are all kinds of reasons for thinking you can't. Perhaps original sin makes men incapable of knowledge to that degree. Perhaps we knew it once in paradise and have lost it because of the flood or because of original sin. Perhaps we shall know it one day when we are the wiser. Perhaps we shall never know it. Perhaps only the angels know it. Or if there are no angels, then perhaps only God knows it. Or if there is no God, then you say, well, perhaps somebody could know it, even if nobody does know it. But at least, in principle, it must be knowable. And if it, what is known is this pattern of all the true answers put together, which between them will describe perfection. Now, we must have some such idea, that is the argument, because if we couldn't conceive of something perfect, we wouldn't understand what is meant by imperfection. If we complain about our condition here below by saying that there are contradictions, there is misery, there is imperfection, there is cruelty, there is vice, there is crime, there is every kind of disaster in human life, this can only be intelligible in terms of the absence of these things, in terms not merely of a negative absence, but of some positive universe in comparison with which our universe falls short. That of which it falls short is the idea of perfection. That, I think, is behind the notion of utopias, and indeed behind the notion of a great deal of Western thought. In fact, central to it, it seems to be, certainly from Pythagoras and Plato onwards. Now, you may say, what are the answers to these questions? About that, all kinds of theories are possible. Of course, people don't agree. Some say they are to be found in sacred books, or spoken by priests, who are the interpreters of these books. Some say nature, science, experiment, observation. Only knowledge of nature gives you the answer. That was said in the 17th and 18th and 19th and perhaps in our own century too. Some say only experts, deep metaphysical thinkers, sages, scientific experts. Others say, no, this is known to every man who looks within his own heart, within his own soul. He knows what the true answers to the most central questions are, how to live and what to do, provided he is not corrupt. That is what Rousseau would have said. Not the corrupt dwellers of sophisticated cities, but perhaps in the heart of the simple, uncorrupted peasant or child, the truth may lie, and Tolstoy thought that too. Again, people may suppose that these things have been known and have been forgotten, or on the contrary, will one day be discovered, or perhaps will never be discovered. About these differences, bloody wars have been fought. And not altogether surprisingly, since if human salvation depends upon it, these are the most agonizing and central questions in human life that there are. But what is assumed by everyone is that there are answers. There is some hidden treasure somewhere. The problem is to find the path. And there is a kind of jigsaw puzzle. If you can put the bits together, it will form a perfect whole. The problem is how to do it. That, I think, is a common assumption of a great deal of Western thought. This certainly underlay the utopias of the Renaissance, for example. When the Renaissance occurred and people went back to the study of the classics and regarded the truth as having been forgotten or corrupted by the monkish superstitions of the Middle Ages, once again you have hope springing in the human breast that knowledge will save us. Behind the whole thing is the great proposition, virtue is knowledge, uttered by Socrates, developed by Plato and by Aristotle. For Plato, knowledge was geometrical in character, for Aristotle, biological, for the certain thinkers in the Renaissance, it may have been organic or mechanical, but knowledge is the thing which will save. Why? For this reason. If men have a nature, this nature must have a purpose. This is assumed. There is something which will fulfill man if only he knew what it was. If you can discover what there is in the world and what your relationship is to it, and what you are yourself, however you discover that, whichever the method, whether it's by religious intuition or scientific observation or any of the other official routes, to knowledge, whichever you think right. Once you discover that, you will discover what will fulfill you, what will realize you, what, in other words, will make you happy, fulfilled, realized. If you know what will do this and not do it, you are irrational. To know how to compass your ends and then not to try and compass them is not to understand your ends. To understand is to act. There is a certain sense in which these earlier thinkers anticipated Karl Marx in thinking that there was a unity of theory and practice. Knowledge means not just knowledge of a descriptive kind of what there is in the universe, in the sense which the science takes of that. Knowledge is also knowledge of values, of what, how to live, what to do, which form of life is better than which. When people commit crimes, they do so because they mistake what will in fact profit them. This is the whole Platonic message. If they knew what would profit them, they would not do these things. Crime, vice, imperfection, misery, all arise from ignorance and idleness. This ignorance may be fermented by wicked people who wish to throw dust in the eyes of others in order to dominate them, and are in the end taken in by themselves. That is Voltaire's doctrine. Virtue is knowledge simply means if you know how to live, how can you help living in the way which you know will realize, will fulfill you. Self-fulfillment is precisely that which all desires, all wishes, all hopes, all aspirations are directed towards. That's what is meant by calling them hopes. That is what is meant by calling them aspirations. To distinguish reality from appearance, to distinguish that which will truly fulfill me from that which merely seems to do so, or is likely to do so, that is knowledge. And that will save. And that lies behind the utopias, for example, of the Renaissance, certainly behind Bacon, certainly even more, certainly in Campanella, certainly in the dozen or so Christian utopias of the 17th century, in Fénelon, in a great many other utopias with which the 17th century was very, very full. Travel stories, discovery of, for example, savages in the Indian forests in America helped towards this process, because these people were regarded as natural men, men not corrupted by error, by civilization, by wicked priests, or by various usurpers and oppressors of various sorts, and therefore taught you what men truly are, how men truly can realize themselves, what kind of satisfaction, serenity, what kind of wholly fulfilled life human beings can lead, away from cities, away from sophistication, away from civilization and so on. All this conspired together towards the notion that knowledge, and only knowledge, true knowledge, alone liberates, alone makes you happy, free and virtuous. It is true that certain doubts were thrown upon this, upon the notion that there were these universal truths, true for all men, everywhere, at all times, that there were universal laws which governed the world and governed men, called natural law. Certain doubts were thrown on it by, for example, Greek sophists, or by, for example, skeptics, both in the ancient world and, say, in France in the 16th century. By thinkers like Montesquieu, for example, who thought that different methods of living suited people in different climates, with different traditions, living on a different kind of soil, and so forth. But this can be overdone, the belief that these people call these things a question. It is true that the sophists thought that fire burns both Kerin and Persia, but customs change under our very eyes, that Aristotle formulates the views of an ancient sophist. It is true that Montesquieu thinks that one should wear warm clothes in Russia and thin clothes in Africa, and that heavy clothes in Africa do not suit the Africans, and thin clothes in Russia do not suit people living amid snow and ice. But what these people are really saying is the different means have to be adapted in different circumstances towards the realization of somewhat similar ends. All these people still think that human ends are uniform and universal. All men want security. All men want to eat and drink. All men want to procreate. All men want justice. All men want a degree of liberty. All men want a degree of self-expression, and so forth. The means towards it will differ from country to country, and age to age, and circumstance to circumstance. But the ends are identical. It is true that a rather graver blow against this was directed by Machiavelli, who suggested doubts about whether it was possible to combine a Christian view of life involving self-sacrifice and humility with the possibility of having a glorious state, a glorious republic, for example, which entails not humility and not self-sacrifice, but rather more what might be called more pagan virtues of courage, vitality, sometimes brutal action, domination, and a certain degree of ruthlessness and unscrupulousness where this was required. He didn't develop this view because he was not a professional philosopher. But what he said certainly called for some value. Nevertheless, broadly speaking, it was ignored. His works were condemned, regarded as immoral, and not taken particularly seriously by the kind of moralists and the kind of political thinkers who dealt with what might be called the question of how human life might be made better. To some degree, I think he did have some influence. He certainly had it on Hobbes, he certainly had it on Rousseau, but by and large, the more uncomfortable assumption in Machiavelli, which is that certain virtues may not be compatible, which offends against the proposition that all true answers to serious questions must be compatible. That, for example, if you say how to live life, if the Christian answer, which is a perfectly good answer in itself, may not be compatible with the pagan answer, which is another good answer, there being no super answer to reconcile these two, this certainly was rather worrying, but was not, as I say, developed too far, perhaps because it was precisely because it was thought to be a little too difficult. And people run away from things which on the whole they regard as painful or agonizing, if they can. There was another side from which these assumptions are questioned. The assumption I mean is that man is one, that human nature is a single, static, unaltering system, that human ends are eternal, unaltering, and universal for all men everywhere at all times, on which the whole doctrine of natural law is based. This was again questioned by, for example, the new states which arose partly as a result and partly in the course of the Reformation in the 16th century. When people, certain lawyers in France, perhaps because of opposition to the domination of the Church of Rome or the domination of the King of France, began to say, Roman law does not hold with us. You say it's based on universal eternal principles, but we are not Romans. We are Franks. We have our Frankish traditions. We are Scandinavians. We have our Scandinavian traditions. We live in Languedoc. We have our Languedoc traditions. What is Rome to us? We are Franks, and we came here, and we conquered the Gallo-Romans, and we hold them under in virtue of our Frankish rights. What Roman law has to say about this is neither here nor there. Doesn't apply to us. Let the Italians live under Rome. We are Franks. We are Germans. We are whatever it may be. And therefore, different nations, different laws. Different people, different communities, different ideals. We have our way of living, they have their way of living. Don't dictate to us. This was certainly a view which was defended by those who wished to resist what might be called the claim to universal authority by, let us say, the Pope. Again, this was already a somewhat dangerous breach in the notion of a single world. The utopia of a Frank might very well be different from the utopia of a Roman. The perfect society in which a Frankish warrior, or even a descendant of a Frankish warrior in the 16th century would be entirely happy, may be a very different perfect world from that in which a Red Indian or a Swede or a Turk might be happy. And therefore there is beginning of a creeping doubt about whether the idea of the perfect universe in which all these people are going to be realized is possible at all, whether there isn't some kind of logical flaw in the idea of a universe which is equally suitable to the tastes of people with very different traditions, with very different character, with very different outlooks, concepts, categories, views of life. However, again, this is not perhaps the implications of this will not fully spell out, largely because, I think, of the enormous triumph of the natural sciences. As a result of the great triumph of Galileo and of Newton, you suddenly had a marvelous single unitary world in which with very few propositions, the movement and the position of every particle of matter could be determined. For the first time, a great chaotic mass of physical observation was reduced to what seemed to be perfect symmetry and order. Why should not the same method apply to human matters, to morals, to politics, to the organization of society have equal success there? Why is man different from other things in nature? What is holds of material objects? What holds of trees and plants? What holds of animals? Zoology, botany, chemistry, physics, astronomy, all these new sciences which are unified, which proceed from observed primitive biological steps to testable scientific conclusions and together form a coherent scientific system verified by observation and by experiment, why shouldn't this also apply to human problems? This is a very tempting proposition, and I think that the 18th century, particularly in France, embraced it with a certain enthusiasm, and once again you had the notion of man. Man as an object in nature. He has an examinable nature, an examinable and physical nature. We can examine trees and rocks. We shall find out what man consists of. We shall find out what he needs for his growth and for his satisfaction. When we have discovered what he is and what he needs, we shall then ask, where can this be found? And when we have discovered that, we shall make inventions and create discoveries for the purpose of finding these things and supplying man with them. And in this way, we shall achieve, if not perfection, something a far more perfect state of affairs than at present prevails. Why does it not prevail? Because of prejudice, superstition, passion, because of ignorance, which leads to fanaticism, which leads to intolerance, which leads to stupidity and vice and cruelty, all of which are founded upon some kind of deliberate failure to observe what there is in the world, to some kind of denial or absence of knowledge. Knowledge will save us again. And this is the fundamental doctrine of the French Enlightenment, and a very liberating doctrine in its time, which certainly eliminated a great deal of cruelty, superstition, darkness, and obscurantism, which was then certainly reigning. However, this produced its own reaction. Let me tell you, whenever things become too rational, there is always, or very nearly always, some kind of emotional reaction on the part, if you like, of that which is irrational in man. This happened in Greece in the 4th and 3rd centuries BC, when the great Socratic schools were produced a great rational, great rationalist construction. Never were there so many mystery cults, never was there so much occultism, never was there so much darkness, never was there so much violent religious searching for all kinds of dark solutions to human problems as in those centuries. The great legal structure of ancient Judaism inevitably bred a violent and emotional Christian reaction. Antinomianism in the Middle Ages was the reaction to the great medieval logical constructions of the schoolmen, and this is roughly what happened in the 18th century also. The reaction came from Germany. Let me say something about this. The position of the Germans, and this is significant for our purposes, the position of the Germans in the 17th and 18th centuries was that in some respects they were regarded as culturally inferior to the then dominant French. If you consider what was happening in Europe in the 17th century, the French were dominant in all spheres. They were dominant in the military sphere, they were dominant in the intellectual sphere with our great thinkers, both scientists and philosophers, painters and artists, certainly in the general art of life, the poets and the writers, the dramatists, the architects dominated Europe. They dominated Europe in every respect. They were, the reign of Louis XIV 20 marks a very high point in what might be called the center of the radiation of French influence through the whole of Europe, which on the whole tried to imitate it, with England not far behind. Towards the end of the 16th, beginning of the 17th century, Spain also was going through a very glorious literary and artistic period. The same is true of Holland and the Low Countries. Italy, if not perhaps at the height at which it was in the 15th century, was still, certainly in science and also in art, at a very considerable cultural height. Germany could not boast of anything similar. If you ask who were the great contributors to European civilization in the 17th century in Germany, even before the 30 Years' War, which is usually held as the cause, there are very few such. In fact, I can scarcely mention the name. This led inevitably to a certain patronizing attitude towards the Germans, a certain kind of jetons bas, a certain kind of contempt, if you like, for the Germans, whose general education was quite high, on the part of the dominant French. In due course, the Germans, the humiliated Germans, began by imitating the French in a rather feeble way, but in the end reacted again. In the end, there was a great deal of wounded national conscience. They felt they couldn't be as miserable as the French evidently thought them. They must be better than that. This is a very common reaction on the part of backward nations who are looked at with too much contempt, with too much patronizing superiority by their grand neighbors. And so by the beginning of the 18th century, a reaction set up. And the Germans began to say, we too are something. We are not nothing. Let the French boast of all their worldly successes. These worldly successes are empty show. The inner life which we Germans possess, the spiritual life, the relation of man to man, the relation of man to himself, the relation of man to God, that is all that matters. These empty French materialists have no notion of what that is. Let them have their arts, let them have their sciences, let them have their salons, let them have everything that they want. This is all perfectly empty form of human triviality. The depth of spiritual life is ours alone. Gradually, this German reaction grew in intensity and in what might be called a kind of nationalist resentment. Until Herder, who was perhaps the first articulate prophet of this attitude, began to say, it isn't true that every people possesses the same values in terms of which it has to be judged. It's not true that there is some kind of universal standard in terms of which the past and the present must be judged, in terms of which different nations can be estimated. As if the French, as Voltaire is right, are at the top of the ladder and we are somewhere near the bottom. We have our values, they have theirs. Every nation has its own tradition. Every nation has its own character. Every nation has its own face. Every nation has its own values. Every nation has the center of its own, has its happiness in the center of moral gravity of its own particular national character. Something of that kind. There is no reason for imitating them. Every age is different from every other age. It isn't true that there is such a thing as continuous progress, so that the later is always the better. It isn't true that Homer is a kind of primitive Ariosto. It isn't true that Shakespeare is simply a rudimentary Racine, to speak. Each culture has its own particular values, which must be considered in and by themselves. Just as when we meet people, when men make friends, I don't make friends with you in terms of what you have in common with everybody else, but in terms of that which is uniquely yours, which is what you have and nobody else perhaps. Your faith, your character, your outlook, that is why I love you and that is why I hate you, if I do. I see you as an individual. Just as there are individual characteristics in individuals, so there are unique characteristics in cultures and in societies. Greek culture is Greek, Roman culture is Roman, French culture is French, and by God, our culture is ours. And not none the worse for that. Take a German and plant him among the French, and he will be unhappy. Why will he be unhappy? Because people are only happy among people who understand them. Solitude is to be among people who don't know what you mean. Solitude is to be among people who get up and sit down, who write, whose handwriting is different from yours, whose accent is different from yours, whose whole education and outlook, the flavor of whose life, the nuance of whose whole being is different from yours. Yes, there are many things which men have in common, but that is what matters. What matters is what they do not have in common. What matters are the differences. What matters is change. This is a very new kind of doctrine. And he says, what the Germans have in common is, there is something about Germans, for example, the way in which they pass their legislation, the way in which they write their poetry, the way in which they get up and sit down, the way in which they do their hair, the way in which they order their political life, all has something in common with one another, which is called being German, a certain German pattern, in which respects they differ from the Chinese or the Portuguese. None of these people are superior to others. He's willing to say every culture is equal with every other. He doesn't wish to say that one is superior to the other, but they're different. And if they're different, they seek different ends. To be happy, it is no good trying to make a German happy by feeding him with French values. It's no good making an American happy by trying to introduce him to the life of Denmark. Everyone must stay where they are, on the soil on which they were born, speaking the language which they speak, indulging in the customs which have brought him into life, born into a river of tradition, which we cannot help, in which we live, and which is closest and most intimate to us. Certainly there are qualities which men have in common, but these qualities are not sufficient to ensure the full realization and fulfillment of a man's nature, which depends upon the place and the time and the culture to which he uniquely belongs. That was Herder's fundamental sermon. I am not here, he said, to think. I am here to be, to live, to act. And every action, every form of life, is directed in a pattern which is different from that of every other. The natural unit for him is not the nation, the natural unit for him is what he calls the folk, the people, or the culture to which he belongs. The chief constituents of which are soil and language, not blood, not race. But if this is true, and no doubt it was the product of a kind of resentful, wounded reaction against the French assumption and the whole previous assumption that all the values are eternal and universal, because in terms of the eternal universal values, the French did very well and the Germans did very poorly. If this was his reaction, then there is something gravely wrong with the very idea of a perfect society. Not so much because it can't be attained, because men are not clever enough, or because men are too wicked, or because men don't know enough, or because it isn't within human power without God's help to achieve perfection on earth, not for those well-known reasons, but because the Valhalla of the Germans is quite different from the paradise of the French. Because a society in which a Frenchman would be realized perfectly is a society in which a German would suffocate. And therefore, so to speak, if we're going to have as many types of perfection as there are types of culture, then the notion of a single perfect society is logically incoherent. This, I think, is the beginning of the attack on the notion of utopia. Utopia as such. The philosopher Fichte pushed this further under the perverting, as he did, the philosophy of Kant. He, in a sense, pushed it further by saying, it isn't true that there are eternal values which are the same for all men, at all times, in all places, which we can only discover by a certain technique, whatever the technique may be, whether the technique is scientific, or the technique is philosophical, or religious, or whatever you like to call it. Values are not there to be discovered. Values are generated by the creative human self. Man is above all a creature not only with reason, but with will. The will is the creative function of man. It's really an aesthetic doctrine which he's producing. It's rather like saying, the picture which an artist paints, is it painted in terms of some kind of eternal value? So Joshua Reynolds said, yes, there is an eternal pattern called, for example, royalty. If he says you are painting a painting of a king, let us say King David of Israel, he may in life have been short, small, with a hare lip, ugly. You have no right to paint him like that because he's a king. Therefore, you must paint him as a royal person. And royalty is an eternal value. It is the same for all people, in all times, at all times, in all places. It is a kind of platonic idea beyond the reach of the empirical eye. And your business as a painter or a sculptor is to penetrate the empirical veil, to conceive of the idea of pure royalty as a kind of metaphysical idea, essence, and then convey this idea in paint onto the canvas or the marble or whatever it is you use. Not so for those who are influenced by the Romantic movement, to which we have come by Fichte. The painter literally creates. He does not copy. He does not imitate. He does not follow rules. He makes. Values are not discovered. Values are not found. They are made or invented. That is what it is meant by calling people creative. Now, who is the creator of these values? Fichte says the self creates them. Who is the self? Well, in Fichte you never can tell. Maybe some kind of world spirit of a metaphysical kind of which I, the individual, am only an emanation. People then identify this self with something else. Some say the self is the nation. That is the true self of which I am only an element. Or the self is the people, as it is in Rousseau. Or the self is the state, as it is in Hegel. Or the self is the culture. Or the self is the historical period. Or the self is a class, as it is in Marx. Or the self is a party. The self is some entity, the business of which it is to generate values which I am bound to follow because they are mine, because I'm not anybody else's. This is a break for the whole previous tradition. The previous tradition held there were certain objective values, the good, the true, the beautiful, the honest, the dishonest, the sublime, which were fixed like stars in the heavens. The only problem was how to discover what they are and how to realize them alone. But if we actually generate these values, if these values are generated sometimes by those which are generated by my culture or by my party or by my class are different from the values generated by your class, if the values generated by Germans are different from values generated by Portuguese, if the values generated by the Greeks, the ancient Greeks, are different from the values generated by modern Frenchmen, this is what Herder said, Aristotle is theirs, Leibniz is ours. Don't assimilate. Aristotle is a great thinker, not for us. Leibniz, ours. If values are created, so to speak, by my class, the bourgeoisie, and not by their class, the proletariat, then the notion that all values, all true answers to questions are compatible with each other is false, because my values will clash with yours. Because the values of my class are not the values of your class. The values of my nation or the values of my period, the values of the Romans, are not the values of the Icelanders. The values of the 18th century are not the values of the 19th. The notion that there is some kind of eternal world in which all these values sit side by side in happy communion with each other, as a kind of marvelous, harmonious system, interlinked by all kinds of logical bonds, which I think is the earlier idea, is completely destroyed. That is really the heart of the Romantic movement. And of course the extreme form of it is in the self-assertion of the rebellious artists, of, as it were, violent heroes, outcasts, outlaws, violent defiers of society, people who simply work out their own particular salvation, no matter with what consequences to others, because they feel superior, because they reject the values of the world in which they are born, because they reject the values of the society in amongst which they live, and realize themselves at whatever cost. Well, this is all highly exaggerated, perhaps, all this kind of romanticism, but it's the essence of it, I mean, the root from which it starts, came to stay and came to worry and to cause anxiety in the entire European consciousness. Against this, there is still an attempt to say the opposite, for example by Hegel, for example by Marx, who say, no, this is not true. There is a single march of history. There is a single march of mankind through certain periods. It is true that these collisions occur, but these collisions are temporary. They are due, let us say, to the class struggle. or they are due to the particular dialectic of the spirit, but they are temporary. These struggles are themselves the preliminary conditions of the ultimate realization of some kind of completely seamless whole, of a completely harmonious state of affairs. The story is a drama for them. Yes, in the drama there are all kinds of contenders. No doubt in the drama terrible tribulations occur, people go through terrible collisions, there are terrible battles, there are deaths, there is violence, there is suffering. But as a result of this battle, in the end, the drama leads to a happy conclusion. The story has a happy ending. And the happy ending is the timeless serenity and radiance of a totally static, happy mankind living in a, after the state has withered away, authority is gone, and all men are virtuous and happy and free and innocent and love one another. This can be attained. It can be attained. That is what we are doing. That is an attempt to both have the best of both worlds. Both to allow for the collisions and to say that they are only an inevitable but ultimately only a temporary stage along the path. Nevertheless, once this has been stated, the doubts persist. And they persist right through the 19th century. That is the heritage, if you like, of the Romantic movement. And there is no way of completely avoiding it or circumnavigating it. And therefore, the notion of perfect society becomes compromised. And that is why people who believe that a perfect society can be created are accused by those who do not think that of trying to foist the idea of perfect society on reluctant humanity, or trying to vivisect these people. Those, for example, who produce the anti-utopias of the present, I mean, Aldous Huxley, George Orwell, Zamyatin in Russia, try and paint a horrifying picture of a frictionless society in which the differences between the vital flow, the multicolored nature of highly differentiated human beings with their different temperaments, their different inclinations, their different ideals, are in some way mechanically and brutally repressed and squeezed into some kind of straitjacket, some kind of artificial uniformity which maims them and hurts them and crushes them and in some way knocks individuality and life out of them. That is the thesis against totalitarianism on the part of these people. And so we have two colliding views. One is the view of those who believe that there is never the right eternal values, that these values are the same for all men, at all times, in all places. That the reason why we haven't yet attained to them is because of lack of the means to produce them, the lack of knowing how to live. This knowledge is perhaps inevitably withheld from us by the nature of history itself. It's not, we're not to blame. The Gulf War, whatever it may be, has sufficiently distorted our relations to each other to blind us to the truth. And only certain persons are able to see it, but soon everybody will. And when they do, there will be a perfect society. That is one view. Against this comes the view of those who on the contrary deny and say that human beings are different from each other, that variety is important, that only those societies are good in which there are a great many opinions, which is not subject to a single ideology, in which there is freedom of thought and of expression, in which opinions clash with each other, the kind of thing which gives vitality and freedom to a society. The sort of thing which Goethe, for example, the German writer Goethe said when he read Holbach's System de la Nature, which was one of the great 18th century encyclopedic works, which produced a kind of rationalist utopia, when he said, this is grey, this is corpse-like, this is not something which anybody could wish. Where is the vital flow of life? Where are the human beings? It's an entirely mechanical affair. It's dead and repellent. Well, you see, so now, the people who will say what matters are the differences in human beings. What matters is individuality. What matters is variety. To crush variety in the interest of uniformity is to crush life itself. These two doctrines are not compatible with one another. They both to some degree dominate mankind at the present moment. If, naturally, if it is true that the first party is right and that there is a final solution to all human ills, which can be attained, in the course of which all men will become virtuous and happy and wise and good and free. If such a position can be attained. So that all mankind will be fulfilled forever in a kind of static condition of unchanging bliss. If this is possible, then one naturally believes that no price is too heavy to pay for that. No amount of oppression, cruelty, repression, coercion can be too high if this alone is the price for ultimate salvation of all men. If one doesn't believe that, then one is reduced to saying all that one can do is to try and create some kind of unstable equilibrium between the different aspirations of different groups, of different human beings, of different temperaments, so as to prevent them from exterminating each other, or prevent them from hurting each other in any way. But this is not a very exciting ideal. The idea of simply a kind of liberal sermon to the effect that what we need is some kind of machinery simply to prevent people from doing each other too much harm, from giving each human group sufficient room to realize its own idiosyncratic, unique, particular ideal without too much interference with the ideals of others is not something which inspires people to what might be called heroic action. Nevertheless, that is the only solution which the other side can possibly adopt. Simply in order to finish, let me tell you that this other solution is something about which there are two sentences which I would like to speak in conclusion. One comes from Immanuel Kant, who was certainly no irrationalist, and who said, we must remember that out of the crooked timber of humanity, no straight thing was ever made. And for that reason, to speak, no perfect solution is in principle possible in human affairs. And any attempt to produce it is likely to lead to suffering and blood, and not, in fact, to succeed, even at the cost of death. The other remark is by the American philosopher C.I. Lewis, whom I'm fond of quoting, who said this: there is no a priori reason for supposing that the truth, when one day it is discovered, will prove interesting. It's enough if it is true. Thank you very much.